Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
Welcome everyone to part three of our seven episodes with Gary Wayne on his amazing book, Genesis 6 Conspiracy Part 2. As was graphically described in the first Genesis 6 Conspiracy book, there are giants among us passing largely unannounced and unnoticed, intent on carrying out a secret plan to enslave all of humanity. They may not look like giants today, but their bloodlines and DNA extend all the way back to the Nephilim, the offspring of the angels who mated with human women, described in the Genesis 6 when giants were roaming the land. Now in this new book, Gary goes in depth with new information and explanations for each premise laid out in the first book. By adding this fact-filled book to your understanding, you'll be able to clearly understand and articulate how we are living in the end of times. This book was written to help answer the lingering questions many Christians have and to provide scripturally research and answer the data points for these questions. This book explores Scripture's accounting of prehistory, history, and its important prophetic connections, and explains in layman's terms how it all fits together in deciphering the end of time. I have to say, I'm reading through it week by week as we come through these different sections, and I'm learning so much that the Bible apparently has that I never noticed. So it's an education in itself, and it's sending me back to the Bible to try to understand how to put it all together, and Gary is doing a masterful job of helping us. So welcome to the show, Gary.
Well, thank you for inviting me back, and thank you for such an awesome introduction. Hopefully I can live up to the praises and, hopefully get some people to look at the Bible in a little bit different way and to give it another look with a little bit of help that I think, brings the Bible and particularly the Old Testament to life in the first five sections of this book. And even though a lot of people told me with book one that it brought for the first time the Old Testament to life and that for the first time they understood the Bible better, this book is targeted at that sort of thought that people were talking about, but in a way that is crafted and directed at the Christian audience, but for also people that, are just interested in prehistory. And, the first book was kind of on the premise of how the Bible intersects with the world's testimony. And each are talking about the same sets of events, just from a polytheist lens or a monotheist lens. And so this book is how the world intersects with the Bible and the sort of how accurate the Bible is, and that everything fits, and it fits on the biblical timeline. So when I used references in book one, I used the common era for dating, and you know, BCE and CE for the datings, and I'm using BC and AC or AD in book two because I'm not using the 2950 to 3050 timeline for the flood. I'm using the biblical timeline according to Emma Mundy, which would be about 2348 BC. So I would give maybe even a little bit of a play in there, say 50 years or so. But I'm using that and showing how the timelines that are provided in the Bible, they actually make sense of the mysteries and the conundrums and some of the chronology that's used by the secular trying to understanding. And, you know, one of the things that people have to sort of remember is that when you're trying to connect different civilizations through the dynasties, that many of the kings, just like the gods, had many names. And so it can be very difficult if you're not able to fully sort of understand and distinguish that a pharaoh, for example, might have had seven different names. And so it's easy to add additional dynasties in there. So there's about a 600-year discrepancy there. But when you start to understand it from the biblical chronology, it really starts to make the Greek history fit and so many of the other histories fit on a time frame that makes sense.
Yeah, I'm beginning to find names that I recognize in the Egyptian chronology interwoven in here, and I'm getting a better feeling for everything. I think the one thing that has blown my mind is, you know, the statement of there were giants before and after the flood, and I had no concept of the numbers of giants that roamed the earth. I mean, it was not just a couple. It was tribes. It was huge numbers of giants, and that had never occurred to me. I mean, it may have sounded like it in the Bible, but in reading through the material that you've put out there, I've become greatly aware as to just how many giants there were and how, in many ways, they almost overwhelmed the human population in many places.
And they did before the flood, and would have if things hadn't changed to a certain degree after the flood. So, yeah, they were prolific in their ability to reproduce. And also, I would say, impose their will over humankind, you know, as their citizens, so to speak, that they would rule over. But not in necessarily a good way for the most part. And there were just so many. And one of the things to try that people I would recommend to try and understand that fog in prehistory and how do you get, you know, what's before the flood and after the flood. And if you understand that there are parent gods in polytheism, like Gaia and Kronos in the Greek pantheon, and then offspring gods after the flood, like Zeus as the head of the pantheon, or Poseidon would be another one. And, you know, you have Anu in Sumeria, you have Enlil and Anki after the flood. These are offspring gods, and they take over after the parent gods go to the pit prison for the crimes that they commit. And then the offspring gods take over. And then they commit the same crimes. And in doing so, they create similar kinds of giants that I distinguish as Rephaim from Nephilim after the flood. And they do that immediately after the flood. Well, not immediately. Let's say after an incident that happens with Ham and the generation of Canaan is going to supply the daughters, as we talked about in the second incursion, to the Baalim gods of that region. And I think all of the pantheons are the same pantheon, just different vernacular names. But in the Ugaritic texts and in that area of the Land of the Covenant and where the Bible comes from, it is the Baalim gods, particularly Baal and Ashtaroth, or Anat after the flood, not Ashtaroth, that are going to reproduce the Raphaim giants after the flood and the assembly of the giants. So when we're talking about a start, it's like a start before the flood, and there's going to be what they call the tribe of Datanu or Datanu, depending on how you want to describe that. And what's interesting is that in the ancient languages, a T and a D were interchangeable. So you would see the word Dedan that would show up in the Bible that would represent, you know, these Danuas or Dedans or the Tuatha Dedananas that would surface in other cultures. But if that was a T, at the beginning, which it could easily be in other languages, like Greek, for example, you would get the assembly of the Titanu, and that first two syllables is Titan. And just as in the Greek mythology, you have Titans from heaven who produce Titans of the earth, those are the heroes of old, you know, like the giants, let's say Gog and Magog before the flood, and let's say Hercules after the flood. These are earthly Titans. And so you start to sort of understand the lens of the history through the flood as the divide line and the parent gods when they rule and then the offspring gods who take over. Now those offspring gods go to the pit prison for the same crimes sometime after probably Babel, and other gods will move up, as we talked about in the last show, as the assembly of the gods is, as it's talked about in Psalms 82, or the assembly of the gods at Mount Hermon or Mount Saphon in the Ugaritic text or at Nippur. These were the, what we call from the Hebrew text, the host. So you have a host of heaven and you have a host of rebellious ones. And that word means in Hebrew, an army of angels. And so other angels would just move up to replace them in the hierarchy. So it starts to make sense that there's a distinction, there's a similarity, there's nothing new that's under the sun, it repeats itself, what was will be again, and that process has been tried to be rekindled throughout our history, and it will all come to fruition in the end times. So the end times is going to be like the days of Noah, both 650 years before the flood, or 600 years before the flood, and 350 years after the flood. And it's important to understand this prehistory because this is a cycle that is happening.
Yeah, and, you know, I think the other thing that I was a little confused with was the Table of Nations and having a patriarch or not having a patriarch. What difference does it make? Is it a matter of, you know, having a human patriarch at the head of one of these nations or not? What is the purpose of the Table of Nations?
The purpose of the Table of Nations is to underline a consistency that the world works in terms of human nations versus the spurious nations that are created through angels and human women to create hybrid angelic human beings, or the Nephilim and the Raphaim after the flood. And that in Deuteronomy 32, as we talked in the last show, was numbered by the sons of Adam.
Uh-huh.
And we get the number of Adam's sons, even though we don't get all of those sons listed in Exodus 1:5, by the sons of Israel or Jacob in Egypt. And there were 70 sons born to Jacob. And then there's 70 patriarchs, not quite, let's just say there are 70 nations listed in the Table of Nations, but only 61 patriarchs. And there are 9 patriarchless nations listed in there. And these are telling us that before the flood, you have nations of humans that are going to number 70 with patriarchs. after the flood by the nations listed in Genesis 10 and 1 Chronicles. There are 70 nations. And then in the future sense, with the fulfillment of the Holy Covenant, there will be 70 nations under Israel in the millennium. And so we look at Deuteronomy 32 as a dual prophecy, important information from prehistory, applicable for the time that Israel was in and the prophet that was providing it through Moses at this point in time, and then end time implications. So that number is very, very important to understand, that there are 70 nations of humans, but those kingships both before and after the flood that are going to rule over those nations are going to be usurped by the giants and populated at the upper classes by the giant nobility elite, which are the royals.
Wow. Well, one name I did recognize that I'm slightly familiar with, of course, is Nimrod. And I wasn't familiar with, you know, his escapades. I realized that he was told to go forth and multiply, and he chose not to, that he created a city very close to where the ark did land, and then built a walled city. And so was Nimrod. He was not a Nephilim, but he was a mighty warrior, and apparently he was able to sire some pretty heavy-duty offspring, because he married or he took to wife a giant or a giantress. I can't remember which it was. A giantress, obviously. He mated with somebody.
Yeah. So Nimrod's a very interesting insertion into the Table of Nations. He is the son of Cush, son of Ham. And So typically after Babel, the Hamites migrated to Africa, which is the land that was bequeathed to the Hamites. But Nimrod stayed where the Tower of Babel was built in Shinar, which is the Hebrew transliteration for Sumer. So after the landing of at Ararat, which is typically sort of thought to be, you know, in the Covenant Land or Asia Minor, and probably more towards Turkey, there's a migration down the original mountain, and they end up settling in Mesopotamia, where they're going to build Babel City and Babel Tower. And so we know Nimrod is in the Table of Nations and is listed as a patriarch, so he has a human father. Now, what we don't get is his descendants thereafter listed in the Table of Nations, because something changes. And what it says about Nimrod is that he became a mighty one. Mighty one is the Hebrew word gibor, which can describe a giant. And, you know, in Joshua 16, you have a verse that is translated from Hebrew as gibor as giant. So you could use that as a basis for giants. But gibor isn't always used to describe a giant. It has several different meanings, and it's used, you know, like 157 or 8 times in the Old Testament, not always to describe a giant. And it's that word became a giant. Like, he wasn't born a giant, if this was indeed a giant, but he became a mighty one. He became certainly Nephilim or Rephaim like, and he was a mighty hunter, Gibor, and a mighty warrior, Gibor, and before God. And he was leading the Noahites, and they were not following orders from God. They were told to disperse and settle the earth, to replenish the earth. Yeah. And they decided they should have Nimrod as their leader, and that they built Babel City and Babel Tower, and they seemed to be making a statement to, you know, God with the insertion of the mystical religion at Babel, that is the allegorical understanding for end time Babylon. Nimrod becomes an archetype, Antichrist archetype figure, but he's making a rotation and defending the people when there shouldn't be anybody there from standard biblical doctrine. And what's really interesting is the Septuagint, and I admit you have to be very careful when using the Septuagint because it has a number of corruptions in it. So in its account of Nimrod, it's saying it made his reputation on the giants, which sort of fills in some of the blanks that maybe one might have inferred more out of the words out of Hebrew if there was a larger explanation from the meanings of the words coming out of Hebrew. And so that word became is the Hebrew word chelal, and it means, defiled. And so he became defiled. He became violated. He disavowed, which might mean disavowed God. He broke a covenant or his word that he had provided as probably a leader originally loyal to God. And that changes. And a lot of this perversion and change is done through rituals, which implies polytheism, and sexual rituals, which, again, may include some sexual encounters. It's not clear, and it's not clear whether or not in that word that all of those meanings should be attributed to became. But chelal is related to the word, or rooted to the word chelah, and A-H is the female plural there, which in most applications is more the exercising or the power or the execution of the meaning of the word to fall. And so he's like a fallen one of the first descendants, and he's third generation after the flood, away from God, but in a spectacular way. So something changed Nimrod, both, spiritually and physically, that he became Nephilim or Rephaim-like. So if it's something, some sort of knowledge and technology, then according to the Gnostics, that's probably what happens, because in the Gnostic and secret society accounts, he receives from Hermes the antediluvian knowledge, which some people attribute that gave him the ability to change or be Nephilim-like. There's an account in Jewish mysticism, and I think it's also recorded in the book of Yasher, where he receives the clothes somehow of Adam and Eve, and that creates additional power that makes him a mighty one. We're not really told, but we do know what he did, and he rebelled against God. And if you're going to survive in that world, you're going to have to take the giants head on. So I think he became a mighty warrior against the giants. And then after the Babel dispersion, he stays in Shinar, and we don't get that lineage, but we get references to some of the cities that he renovated, built. I think these are antediluvian cities that he takes over. And that, the cities like Nineveh for the Assyrians and Babel in the Babylon area, and then the Akkadians are connected to him as well. So he seems to start a bloodline with these aboriginals that are there, which are the Rephaim giants. And so he's either going to do that, he's going to either take a female goddess, which he's associated with as well in polytheist accounts, to create Rephaim giants or a different type of Rephaim giant, or he's going to intermarry with a literally he's going to have to, because there's no other people, he's going to have to intermarry with female goddesses to create a bloodline. So one might look at later where there are more hybrids around, where he may have taken some wives from that hybrid stock as well. But either way, he's going to create royal bloodlines. And that's exactly what a lot of experts on prehistory and genealogies, and particularly Lawrence Gardner, wrote extensively on this in numerous numbers of books. And that He said that he actually did intermarry with the giants to create the first hybrid human bloodline dynasty. And I make the case that those people would be the Elamites, whom the Elamites are listed with the descendants of Shem, but I think they accept the name of the giants named Elam, and or vice versa. But typically, when you look at that word Elam, it's associated with Olam, as you take that back to Hebrew, and it means basically the ancient ones of the East. And so I think he's intermarrying with giants, and that the Elamites are a race that most historians say that there's a distinction between the original Elamites and the Shemites who take on that name in their beginnings, but they merge into one nation. And I think that is perhaps part of that whole Nimrod intermarrying and starting these bloodline dynastic royals that are going to produce beast empires down the road. So you're going to get Assyria out of that bloodline. You're going to get Babylon. A Persian's going to be a succession to Babylon, but it's more a different vein or bloodline of the Indo-Aryans. And so this gets to be an important understanding of the Old Testament, is what's happened at Babel has a sort of a rippling effect down through the early history, and Mesopotamia becomes very, very powerful through many empires that are going to dominate much of the geopolitical landscape of the early post-Diluvian age.
So some of these nations don't have a patriarch at their head. Is there something it seems to me that you have to have a patriarch at the head of a nation. What causes a nation to be created without a patriarch?
Yeah, and what you're referring to is the Canaanites in the Table of Nations. So mm-hmm. Canaan is the son of Ham, so from the same sort of family tree as who Nimrod comes along, and Canaan doesn't move to Africa either and settles in the covenant land, oddly. And so you have Canaan, who's going to produce two sons who are named, and there's 12 Canaanite tribes. Nine of them are called families, and they do not have a patriarch. So you get a Canaanite, a Canaan patriarch. You get a Heth, who produces the Hittites patriarch, and Sidon, who produces the Sidonian people. And again, all coming down through the fathers, through the patriarchs of the 70 nations. But then you have nine nations that do not have a patriarch. They're the only ones in the Table of Nations that doesn't have a patriarch. So you've got, you know, like the Jebusites and the Amorites and the Girgashites and Hivites and Arkites and Arvadites and Zamorites and Hamathites and Sinites that do not have a patriarch. And most people just say, well, they're associated as offspring nations of Canaan, Sidon, and Heth. And I think that might be partially true, but they would have a patriarch, like all the sons that are listed in the other two sons of Ham. I mean, there's a direct lineage and sons and their sons that have names and associated with the names of these tribes. But these ones do not have that same patriarch, and it's a mystery for most people. But if you look at that word that's associated with these nine tribes, they're called families, which is very odd. You know, again, the only place in the Table of Nations that it says families, and so That's the Hebrew word mishpacha. And it's an interesting, it can mean a family, but it can also mean a species or a kind, just as you have animals that are taken to the ark by their kind, that means species and or aristocrats. And so there's something different. It's like a different clan that's associated with the Canaanites, but not directly through the patriarch of these nine families or nations. And they're very powerful nations, like the Amorites. I mean, and the Jebusites. I mean, the Amorites at some point in time, is most all of the nations of the land of the covenant are referred to generically as Amorites. They become so powerful. So there's an importance here. And one of the things that we learn about studying the arrival of giants after the flood is that these nations pop up without patriarchs in the table of nations. So, you know, for example, the Rephaim in Genesis 14 and Genesis 15. And I open up this section with a passage out of Genesis 15 where it's the Rephaim are listed in the 10 nations. It includes a mighty seven and an additional three. So I call that addition of the three to be the mighty 10. You have nations like the Kenites and the Kenizzites and the Kadmonites do not have patriarchs. And you have the Perizzites does not have a patriarch in the table of nations, and you have the Rephaim who doesn't have a patriarch. And so it sort of hit me at some point in time that patriarchs creating nations of giants are not listed in the table of nations descending from the sons of Noah, and so they're not included in there. So but you need a little bit more than that. So that's just sort of, you know, that's one piece of the pie or of the puzzle. But, you know, there's another one that is provided to us. And Rapha can mean, just so that people understand, it can mean, in this case, as a tribe of giants or a generic for giant or a specific giant that's unnamed. But also it's used in its various applications as it extends out of 7497 for giant for specific people that are called Rapha as a name. And so you'll have, like, you know, Beth Rapha, for example, the house of Rapha, talking about a specific house and a dynastic bloodline of Rapha. And so it can mean and likely means that the tribe that is named Rapha probably from a patriarch named Rapha is the progenitor to the Rephaim tribe that shows up in Genesis 14 and Genesis 15. With the Anakim, which is another famous race of giants that most people might be familiar with, in the book of Joshua, it says that Arba is the greatest of the Anakim and the patriarch of the Anakim. But Arba doesn't show up in the table of nations. And in Genesis 15, you have other nations that are listed that do have patriarchs, like the Hittites from Heth, and Canaanites from Canaan. But as part of the mighty seven, that is a part of the mighty 10 there, Amorites don't have a patriarch, Girgashites don't have a patriarch, and the Jebusites. And these are the mighty nations, the mighty seven that Israel down the road is going to have to go to war against. So we take now another example to sort of bring this into more clearly sort of understood pattern or MO of the Bible, is that there are other peoples that show up in the area of Edom, and in Genesis 36 and also in First Chronicles, you get an accounting of the dukes of Edom, and these are Horim people. And there's more than these giants, but this is just to make the point. The Horim are described in Deuteronomy 2 as giants, and that's the Hebrew word Rapha for giant. So similar type of giant and similar type of origination as Rapha, Raphaim, and Anakim, who are also listed as giants, Rapha, in Deuteronomy 2, as are Avim, Zamzuzin, and Emim. Now, what's interesting about the Horim is that there's a Duke Seer that lived in Eden from before time. So you can understand that either before the flood and survived, or since the beginning of the flood. And the Raphaim were the aboriginals throughout the covenant land, so created very shortly after the flood. And in the genealogies, that's an addition to the Table of Nations, but not included, you have a son of Esau named Eliphaz. And he is going to marry Timnah, the daughter of Seir, the Horim. And Timnah is a female giant. And as we talked about in the previous shows, is when they're going to start a new dynasty, they're going to use a purebred, rare, because of the fertility issue, female, and another very important dragon or patriarchal bloodline. And in this case, Eliphaz, who is son of Esau, lost the blessings, the inheritance, and the Messianic promise to his brother Jacob. And Esau was the elder. And so there is a bitter rival there between the two. And so now they're creating this other dynasty that are going to create the hybrid giants, the Amalekites. And they are eponymously naming him Amalek after the Amalekim giants that are listed in Genesis 14, which predate this by a few hundred years. And so we have this intermarriage to create this hybrid giant, and they're going to move to the Petra area and the Seir area where the Amalekim lived. And they'll associate with the giants. So there in a location, you have these pureblood giants, and then you have the human-giant hybrids that they're living amongst. And these giants that are hybrids that we're talking about are 7 to 9 feet tall versus 10 feet to as great as 19 feet tall, which if you go outside the Bible, you'd get that 19-foot size from Gilgamesh. If you're staying within the Bible, the tallest giant we would have would be Og, and based on his bed size of 9 cubits, which would be close to 16 feet on a royal cubit, and he was the king of Edrei and Ashtaroth, and so measured on a royal cubit as Josephus testifies to, which is 21 inches versus a standard 18, that would put them 14 to 15 feet tall. So even biblically, they're going to range from 10 to 15. 12 feet is kind of a standard in other cultures for post-Diluvian giants like Orontes or Achilles and many other giants that are listed in Greek mythology. But we get this hybrid race that is the same MO as what's going on with these patriarchless giants that patriarchless Canaanite nations in Genesis 10. So I'll just take a breath of air and let you back in there before we start maybe in on the different hybrid giants listed in the Canaanites.
Well, I think what is confusing to me slightly is clearly the giants were here to destroy humanity. But they were also such a warring nation that they were let loose, they would have ultimately destroyed themselves. I mean, was there ever a good giant? I mean...
Oh, I think so, sure. As I cover off later in book two, there's a tribe of giants that are associated with the Hivim. And these are the ones that live at Gibeon, and these are the Gibeonites, but they're part of the Hivim Pentapolis, and Gibeon is the most powerful city fortress of mighty ones, of Giborim, so either of human warriors or hybrids or of giants, depending on how you want to understand that sort of that application there. And the Gibeonites, they deceived Joshua that they're foreigners, and they have heard as what happened in the Eastern campaign to the giants, and they don't want any part of this. and they saw what happened at Jericho. And Jericho was a mighty city, as what Gibeon was, one of the great mighty cities of the royal cities of the land. And so they made a peace treaty with Joshua that God will honor. And so they become temple servants. And they become bloodline temple servants, that you get a bloodline of these giants that are in the Bible that show up in the time of King Solomon. And then again, after the return from the exile from Babylon for the second temple region, and they're called the Nephilim there. And I make all of those connections that these are giants that are going to work as woodcutters and temple servants, and to work within the temple or around the Holy of Holies, and not saying they were entering into the Holy of Holies because that was only for a few, but they would have had to have converted and been followers of the God of the Bible. So one can take that as an example. And another example might be is that within the mighty men of David, and the Israelites aren't giants, so again, these were warriors, there are some individuals that are listed, like Uriah the Hittite, that is probably a hybrid giant, and I'll talk about, I can come back to that in a minute. If people want to know how did the Hittites turn into hybrids versus just the descendants of Canaan and humans. And there's a Makathim, and Makkah is not listed in the Table of Nations either. That was a tribe of giants around Mount Hermon. He's definitely a giant, and he's fighting with David's mighty men. So one presumes they're either just a mercenary and they're not following it, or perhaps they were converted because they fight with pretty good loyalty and zeal in David's mighty men. I mean, you can make a case for the Pelethim and the Cherethim, which were definitely mercenaries hired to protect David, as being giants that were hired out of the Philistine Pentapolis in empire, that they may not have converted because they're just there for the money and for protection. But with what they're going to do with David, that's a bit different. So I think that every sentient being has the ability to choose what they want to believe. And so I know some people will disagree with me, but I don't think that your DNA necessarily prevents your salvation or that you could follow God. It may have some additional struggles that come with that, but I don't think it dictates what you do. It may have a big influence, but it doesn't dictate that. So I think, yeah, there were some good giants.
Well, it just seems that the purpose of them was to destroy the human race. I mean, isn't that what Lucifer wanted to do?
It did.
Okay.
And they almost did that before the flood. So if you look at the context of what's happening before the flood, you have all of this violence. And we just don't look at that in the right manner in terms of the technology that they had. In their violence of war and the technology that was provided by the fallen angels, they had a technology that we're just catching up to. And that this technology had the ability to destroy the whole world. And that because they had counterfeit spirits, their spirits wouldn't sleep, and they would be provided for in after the destruction of the earth with a renewal of the earth, as in the Shiva doctrine of you have to destroy the earth to create the new world. But it wouldn't be a world for humans. It would be Oikitarians created for these disembodied spirits that could live forever in this new physical realm, separate from God and still worshiping the pantheon of the gods. But God stepped in with the flood to ensure that that didn't happen, so that all the names that were written in the Book of Life from before creation have a chance, an equal chance, since Adam, to have their names kept in that Book of Life and not blotted out. Everybody will have an opportunity to choose what they believe and will be held accountable for that. And so it was an intercession to ensure that that could happen. And so after the flood, there's something different about the giants. They're probably not as tall, and they're not, don't have as many gifts passed on. And in Genesis 6:3, in the passages that are the preamble to the flood story for context, and in the middle of the creation story of the Nephilim giants that were before the flood, is life is limited to 120 years. And so something else tends to happen with the giants after the flood, and it's a fertility issue. So I get that from how these giants are described, and I covered this off in the shows before, but just for people maybe haven't listened to the other shows yet, they're called terrible ones in the Old Testament, another word for giants. And Ezekiel 32 is a terrific passage on it. I won't go through all of that, but it's the terrible ones is the Hebrew word erit, and ones as being plural, and as in Nephilim as the giant ones, or seraphim as the serpent dragon-faced angels with six wings. You have the eretim, which are the terrible ones, and the plural that would come along with that. And within that definition, which are all descriptions of what these tyrants were like, you have a couple interesting definitions that says that they were childless and had a fertility issue. And an extension of that is that I think it was more they had an issue with producing women because they were rare. And so it was the rarity and the ability to pass on their blood type through the DNA being passed on that passes down through the female in their belief system that some people would attribute to Rh negative blood, and I wouldn't disagree with that. I have a document on that if people want to get a hold of me, that would continue their race because without the ability to produce enough women and how violent they were, they would have gone extinct. And so they had to, at a certain point, and not that long after Babel, have to start intermarrying with the humans in the Table of Nations so that they wouldn't go extinct. And they would limit the amount of that interaction to keep as pure those bloodlines as possible. But through the generations, you have to continue to regenerate. Otherwise, you're going to get blood diseases. And so there's a dilution that happens over time with that. And so they're, what they look like would be diluted. Their size would be diluted, and they would become more human-like over the millennia.
Yeah, that's so, you know, your description says there are giants among us passing largely unnoticed, intent on carrying out the secret plans to enslave all humanity. So what you're suggesting is that the bloodlines have stayed as accurately pure as they could be over 2,000 years or longer, and that
yes.
now these spirits are walking around, but their intent is to enslave humanity as opposed to benefit it.
Well, to enslave them and then to ultimately lead them into complete destruction. So you have a limitation of how the knowledge is being applied that has taken forever to catch up to what was before the flood. You have people that are settled all over the earth. You don't have these great numbers of these giants. They lose their advantage in size and in numbers very quickly. So they kind of move to a position of trying to rule over and enslaving humankind, but ultimately with a destiny to have a showdown with the God of the Bible to win their freedom and to walk amongst their gods on this earth with a new realm. And that is what we're seeing playing out through the royal bloodlines throughout of the world. And it's just the knowledge hasn't been there to get them to the point where they can pull this off. But as we can see, as we advance in our technology, we're starting to see technology that is becoming very much like the angelic technology that was used before the flood, from the ability to destroy the earth, and DNA manipulation, genome manipulation, things that would not have been imagined that we could do outside of the occult history for a reference point, you know, a few hundred years ago.
Well, that's for sure. I know, just, you know, looking at, you know, the world today, quite obviously there is warrior attributes that are beginning to show in different nations, and people in power appear to be intent on conquering countries and nations where before there hadn't been that. There had been more of a peaceful nastiness, I guess. But
well,
you know, we're seeing war break out all over.
Yeah, there's been a limited ability to extend the influence all over the world. Even the great beast empires, even from the Roman Empire to the Egyptian Empire, couldn't expand beyond a certain point. And typically, from a military perspective, is you can only supply a certain geography before you start to exhaust your ability to manage that. So it takes a technology in place to you know, allow you to exert a complete world empire that the seventh empire is going to be. And it's going to be a beast empire. So when I talked about beast empires connected to Nimrod, they're connected to Rephaim as well as beast empires of the royals. So it's important to sort of look at this understanding that these royals, even though they're working to a common goal, they have rivals, and they don't want to sort of permit that their bloodline won't be the one that's going to run the world. And so I don't know if people are familiar with a movie and TV series that were in the 80s and 90s, and it was called Highlander. And it's this warrior class would take head,
oh, yeah,
and they're doing a quickening, right? The fairy sort of,
yeah,
allegory side versus the, you know, gaining the energy through drinking the blood. And there can only be one that's going to run the world. That's kind of the allegory that's going on in there. And these are kind of like Nephilim or Rephaim warriors that are fighting it out. So you have these bloodlines that have been rivals throughout. And so they have some, what I would call history turning points, where they do things that, you know, destabilize the whole world order, and that a couple of those that would be more recent in history would be the fall of the Putyanin bloodline in Russia, and that was with the fall of the Romanovs, which were a junior offshoot in the 1600s through intermarriage that took over the Putyanin dynasty that was set up in about 1000 AD with Vladimir the Great, who Putin honors greatly. And there, the Putyanins were the original czars of Kiev. And these are Scythian or giant bloodlines, and that they were considered within the occult families as being a superior or more pure bloodline than the severely diluted bloodlines that came out of the Middle East and then settled in Europe to take over European dynasties. You have another, I'll come back to the Romanovs in just a second, but you have another diaspora that goes on within the European geopolitical network with the Basques, who believe themselves and were the original settlers and believe themselves in their mythos to be Homo Atlantis, who started Egypt, Scythia, Mesopotamia, and then settled in southern France and northern Spain. And they believe that they have the most pure bloodline, and that they considered the migrated bloodlines out of the Middle East inferior. And of course, these European bloodlines, they did a diaspora with the Basques to ensure they had power over Europe. And then getting back to the Romanovs, they created something called social masonry, which is the beginnings to communism and socialism and anarchism and national socialism for the Nazis. And so they launched that at the end of World War One against the Romanovs to take that bloodline down. And then with national socialism, they had to create that because communism got out of control. And that basically, between that, finished off the Kaiser bloodline in Middle Europa, eventually took the Habsburg sort of down with it as those consequences went down. Then they took this social masonry virus and they set it on the dragon sons of heaven dynasties in China and brought down the Shah bloodline. And of course, Xi is a bloodline from the Western bloodline of the Shah dynasties, from the original Sons of God. So you have these bloodlines that are still kind of resurfacing, and I think we're going to see more of that as we see more of this inexplicable perpetual war that's going on, because that's who they are. And they really don't mind destroying this world because they're looking for this new age where they believe their immortal spirits will be provided for with oikotarians or clone bodies or whatever they're going to put them in to move forward into eternity away from God and with humankind exterminated.
Yeah, it's the more you look, the more you see some of this happening, not relating it, of course, to a bloodline, but it's there. And you do begin to wonder, I understand God has a plan. And I find it so hard to believe that his plan is that we kill each other off until there's only a certain number of us left. That doesn't feel right to me. So
that's not his plan.
Well,
his plan is no. I mean, so what happens is God wants people to follow him and to be loyal to him, and he wants you to choose that. So first comes, and he's Alpha Omega, so he knows every choice that's going to be made and every possible sort of outcome. So he's greater than free choice. So angels were created immortal and with intimate knowledge of God, yet a full third have rebelled. And so the Adamites were created as a resolution to the angelic rebellion, and that they wanted to destroy humankind, and they created spurious offspring to do it for them so they wouldn't get blood on their hands because they know how powerful God is. And so none of this is what God would like to see happen. It's by the choices that are made. So you see Adam and Eve that are created in Genesis 2, and there's a deception sponsored by Satan that inspires the serpent to deceive Adam and Eve, and you get this fall. And so that's a choice that Adam and Eve made. Then there is the choice of the Canaanites to supply human women to create the Nephilim, to create this problem on the earth before the flood. And then after the flood, you have Canaanite daughters who are going to choose to marry fallen angels to produce giants again after the flood and start the cycle all over. This is all choices made by humankind, but he is letting it play out because he knows eventually how it all ends and has inserted a resurrection plan as the ultimate playing out of this. And so Israel was created and they were given a holy covenant. And just as with Adam, things could have played out a lot easier and without all of this horrific stuff if they had chosen properly. And so in Genesis 3:15, you get this curse prophecy of the serpent seed that we talked about in previous shows. Same thing happens with the Holy Covenant. They have a choice to follow God, and it's going to be a lot better future. and shorter probably, and all the names will be fulfilled under different circumstances, and they choose not to follow God. And so we don't see that history playing out and the Messiah coming through the blessings of the covenant, through the curses of the covenant, which will play out until the reconciliation of that covenant in the end time when everything comes together. So all of this is what we bring on ourselves. But by the influence of the ones who have corrupted this world and then the spirit's offspring that they give divine power to rule over humankind. It's not how God would like things to play out. It's how it has to play out so that everybody had free choice. And if there was better choices made all the way throughout, whether it's angelic or human, we wouldn't have all of this violence on the earth.
Well, what is it about the human species that has to have gods, that's plural, to worship? What is it about the species that needs to have something that is more intimate that they can touch to worship, as opposed to an etheric energy that is just out there and doesn't have form?
I think that's just how the influence of the fallen angels through their offspring has prepared people and forced people. And once you hit a critical mass, you have the ability to, you know, eliminate people if they don't want to follow your belief system. You just kind of expunge it. And so that comes, you know, as part of the violence. And we're going to see that really come to full fruition again in the end time. So there's going to be terrific tribulation of the saints. And I know in standard Christian dogma, people think that they're going to be raptured before, but we're told we're going to go through tribulation. The only thing we're not promised to go through is two things. One is the year of the Lord's wrath, and then the other one is the hour of temptation or trial. And that's an hour that is akin in biblical time. I'm going to talk about it in the latter part of the book. Is the same hour that Antichrist receives the power from the seven kings at the midpoint of the last 7 years, and the same hour that Babylon is destroyed, and the same hour where there's going to be multiple Antichrists that are going to be deceiving people. That's talked about in the epistles of John. It's the Greek word hora. And this is what we're going to be saved from, that temptation, because even the elect would be deceived that Antichrist is the true Messiah, lest we were saved from that. So there is a savings, but it doesn't mean we're not going to go through tribulation. There are 10 days of tribulation, as it's talked about in Revelation 3. That's 10 years, as we understand that, with a day as a year in prophetic allegory. And so there's a tribulation before the last 7 years. There's a tribulation of the saints in the first 3.5 years. And then there's the great tribulation of those who aren't, who haven't been killed or haven't been raptured, that we're going to have to go through. And the price is you have to earn your salvation through fire, because if you take the mark or worship Antichrist, you're going to the lake of fire so forever. So there was going to be great tribulation for Christians in the end time. So it's about what the world is doing to itself.
But it's, you know, you're speaking of Christians, but isn't it all of humanity that will be going through this?
Well, ultimately, yes, because the whole world would be destroyed lest Jesus stepped in. All flesh would be saved, or would be destroyed. So, yes, eventually they destroy themselves. But for the belief system of those who believe they still have within them these immortal counterfeit spirits, they believe that they're going to be looked after with the destruction of the earth. It's like the allegory of the phoenix rising out of the ashes. I don't know whether or not there's still these counterfeit spirits in the royales or not. I don't think so. But I do know that's what they believe.
Well, it seems to me that what one practices in public isn't always necessarily what one believes inside in private. So is going to be quite interesting to watch. I know that
very very interesting to watch and painful.
Actually that too, but you know, having some idea as to the process gives you some idea as to what is going to be evolving. I think one of the things that fascinated me, and it's a piece of trivia, but when Noah was drunk and asleep, one of his sons either pulled back his clothing or he saw him naked, and he was cursed because of it. And you go into great length as to describing that seeing somebody naked is more than seeing them naked. And I think that's important for people to understand that particular part of the Noah story.
Yeah, and this happens in Genesis 9. So right mm-hmm. after the ark lands and before the people go down and in the first sort of generation or so afterwards. And this is a time probably before Canaan is even born. And so what happens is they're on Mount Ararat, and it's going to be named Ararat after this incident. And this means the curse, and this is going to be another curse prophecy. So immediately after the flood, after all of what the three sons would have seen and survived from, the miracle of that is that when Noah becomes drunk, he's going to walk in on his father and see what it says. He saw his father was uncovered in the tent. And this is written in the Leviticus laws and other passages of similar meanings. And I cover them all so that people know in book two what I'm referencing to is that these are sexual laws. When you are uncovering somebody, you're having a sexual thing that is going on, and usually it is understood that it is a female that you're uncovering. And so this would be either, you know, a daughter of Noah, or it would be a wife of Noah, and that the shame would go on both the father and to his wife or one of his daughters that would have the accompanying shame. But within the details of all of these examples is that the uncovering of the sexual nature is always talked about, and the person who is uncovered is identified, even though the shame will go to the mother and the father as well, not just the father if it was like the daughter, for example. And so the one afflicted is named. Even though there's that extending shame. And so what's interesting in this account is most people think that Ham violated Noah's wife, but she's nowhere to be talked about in the passage. So when Noah becomes drunk, Ham, who is identified as the father of Canaan, who isn't in existence that we're aware of at this point because he's listed in Genesis 10, and this is the first time Canaan shows up and doesn't say Canaan is born at this point, saw the nakedness of his father. So Noah is named. And then as we understand that, that means he had sex with Ham. I mean, Ham had sex with Noah. So it's a homosexual violation, a rape as well, that is an abomination as it's discussed in the Old Testament law. And out of that comes this curse that Canaan is going to be, there's going to be a curse of servitude that's applied to Canaan, one of the sons of Ham, but not to the other brothers and not to Ham. And so this becomes a select curse for somebody probably not even born. And this is one of those curse prophecies with the authority of God again. And Noah, when he awoke from his drunkenness, he knew what his younger son had done to him. I mean, it's quite explicit that this is done to him. And he said, cursed be Canaan, servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren. So there's one of the sons who is going to be cursed to be a slave nation, vassal nations. And I think this is the inspiration when Canaan is born to say, why am I being selected? I didn't do the crime. Why should I be the servant? And rebels against that and says, I'm going to move into the land of the covenant, God's land that he's going to bequeath, that he had, you know, he's going to bequeath later to Abraham. And they're going to supply Canaan as and probably even at the time of Babel or before, is going to supply his daughters with the fallen angels to create the Rephaim. So shortly thereafter, when after Ararat and after Canaan is born and marries and has daughters, he's going to say, I'm going to supply daughters, number one, to create these giants. And then I'm going to go move amongst the aboriginals after Babel, and we're going to continue to intermarry and live with these giants after Babel. And so they're using the power of the giants to try and, you know, not have that curse of being a servant nation by creating a military force and a people that are going to protect them. And they're the ones that are protecting the Canaanites in the War of Giants in Genesis 14. Even though they had become, with the Canaanite Pentapolis, they had become vassals of the Ur, the third dynasty, and then they stop paying and they rebel against that. You have the four giant kings coming out of Nimrod's Mesopotamia, and they're going to attack the giants first before getting the Pentapolis at the end of that War of Giants to make them a vassal again. And so even though they tried to do that with the Rephaim, there's a pull back and forth between Egypt and Mesopotamia where they're going to be struggling to maintain their freedom from the more powerful nations.
Well, one of the things that was I was fascinated with, when you're describing the giants in many places, you're saying dark hair, curly beards, dark hair, curly beards. And then along comes the Anakim, who are blonde-haired and blue-eyed giants. So where did they come from? I mean, this is every giant that is described, you know, thus far is dark-haired, curly beard. And then there are the blonde ones. Where did they come from?
It's a very, very good question for sure. And if you look at another tribe that's amongst the covenant land, there's the Horim. And they are red-haired and pale-skinned. So the Mesopotamian ones you correctly described as dark-haired and black, usually depicted with black beard, just as Nimrod is depicted that way, as is Gilgamesh. So you have different watchers that create the giants. And so I think when you look at the Rephaim and their blonde hair and the red hair, it's very similar to the Atlanteans and other people I cover off in book one with red hair and blonde hair. And they tend to come from, I think, the Seraphim Watchers, which had more of that serpentine look. But yet there's these dark-haired ones that sort of go, and most people's research kind of unaccounted for. And I think they come from a different watcher. And interestingly enough, Gilgamesh is quite a bit taller, and he's accounted for as he's 11 cubits tall and 4 cubits wide in several depictions, not just in the Epic of Gilgamesh, but in the Akkadian versions and also in the Ugaritic texts has the same dimensions to him. And there's a connection between these civilizations as well. And so he's much taller, not as tall as the ones before the flood, but maybe starting to get a little bit closer. And I talked about the Olam, the Olamim in Hebrew, and these are also the children of the East. These are the giants of the East. And the Indo-Aryans, which secular historians tend to talk about Indo-Aryans as being in four to five different groups, associated and related, but distinct somehow as well. And within that accounting, there's also these dark-haired Aryans. Again, I'll get more into this as you get into the various giant nations in section four. But I think that this is coming from a different watcher. And so if we look at depictions of how Anunnaki show up on reliefs in Mesopotamia, you have these bird-faced Anunnaki with wings, and they're big, stocky individuals, and they're doing this sort of ritual around some sort of technology, or some people will refer to it as a kind of a tree of life of some sort, but definitely a technology of some sort. And then you see the identical relief and depiction, but they don't have a bird's face. They have a human face. And these are warriors as well, and almost even more heroic type of warriors. And then you also have these like Greek giants that are dark-haired as well, and you have the Syrian kings that are depicted in that same sort of manner. So there's another stream that's in there. And if we look at another one of the watcher groups, you have cherubim. And the cherubim have... I think are the dark-haired ones. And when they took a specific face, and they had four faces, they had the face of a human, they had a face of a bull, they had a face of a lion, and the face of an eagle or a bird or a falcon or a raven, however you want to describe that bird face, and that when they took a physical form as a human with dark hair, that they procreated and created those kinds of giants. And I think that's a separate strain of the giants. And that's who Nimrod gets associated as well and is depicted as, just as he became a mighty one and his descendants would have taken on that black-haired variety as well.
I think also in a lot of the Egyptian statuary, they have these huge, massive statues of people, Egyptians, sitting on these huge thrones. I've often thought that they were actually, they were actual size. They were not just, blowing somebody up to be more important, that they actually had giants of that size at that particular point in time.
Yeah, I think when we look at the depictions, we see sort of normal humans, and then we see, giants. And then there's even larger ones, and I think what that is doing is showing when the gods took their form, they took a very large form, and then the giants were actually giants, which were their divine offspring, and both of them, they both made the humans look small by comparison. One of the things I was going to mention as well about the blonde hair is that the Amorites are depicted with blonde hair, and they are... hybrid humans and giants, and these are part of the patriarchless tribes. And if you look at that word Amorite, and you can take that back to its Hebrew as Amor or Emori in the singular, as opposed to Emorim as it would be if there were giants. So a particular patriarch, similar to probably Hamor, or as it's shown in the New Testament as Amor, might be the name, and very similar to a name that would go along with one of the Baalim. And in the Baalim, you have a god named Amor, and typically you also have, and again, understanding that there's more than one of the Baals, he's also known as Amar, Martu, and he created, or people that worshipped him, or probably created a people that were called the Amaru, or as we would know as the Amorites. And I take the word etymology back in several different ways of defining Amorite as how I get back to patriarchs, as one of the ways you get back to patriarchs, as well as places that are named after. But in the Ugaritic text, there is this Amur god as well, and he also has offspring in the Ugaritic text. So Amur is referred to as a god and also a servant of the gods, of Baalim, as in the demigods. And so there is a hybrid, there is a giant tribe of Amur as well, or at least a specific one named Amur, who is probably the patriarch for the Amorites. And they had blonde hair. And so I'm thinking the Anakim had blonde hair. I'm probably thinking, as you're probably connecting the dots here, is that there is a blonde hair variety that's in the Baalim gods and in the offspring that are produced. And then there's also the red-haired variety as well, probably from a different god and a different patriarch. But I get into those patriarchs in section four.
Well, I think also the elongated heads as well are another one of the features that we have seen, you know, skulls of certainly that are elongated, that were not created artificially, but that were of quote-unquote natural whatever. And, you know, that would indicate that there was a linkage to, you know, some way back in history that it might have been a genetic trait that was carried through time through people's DNA that would produce that. Go ahead.
I was going to say, in throughout the Middle East and around the world, is the early kings were all depicted with various forms of these huge hats that were covering their heads. And uh-huh. We get the benefit in some of those reliefs and things, particularly in Egypt, where the kings aren't wearing some sort of hat to cover these big cone heads, so to speak, that you actually see this huge elongated skull. And Akhenaten and Nefertiti, for example, are two of the more famous ones. You could Google and find images of that. And the thing you can't do with binding of skulls that people say is what creates that elongated effect, you can do that at childhood. And they did that to emulate the demigods. But you can't create more volume. It's just a longer, slender head. It's not, you know, this big, huge head that has more cranial volume to it. And the other thing you can't recreate is that these elongated skulls don't have sutures, where human skulls do. So there's something distinct within the DNA as well, not only the size but the DNA. And that whole depiction in terms of the serpentine look fits perfectly. But typically you don't get that type of extended conical head with the Mesopotamian giants. They're larger, but they're not that elongated skull. And I haven't really figured out what that is, but it might have something to do with the different kind of watcher that would have reproduced those dark-haired giants.
With the larger skulls, with the larger bodies, does that infer a brain that is capable of more than those of us with a smaller head and smaller brain?
Well, from size, you would make an inference there, but even with our small brains, so to speak, we only use very little of it. So it's
6-8%,
more when you get down to, it's the how much of it could you utilize. And they thought of themselves as superior, not only in their physical size, but also in their intelligence. As I get later into the book, I'll talk about some of the telepathic abilities that they believe that they once had, that they could work together with. And that's that sort of hive mind idea, and that they could do great things by working together that they couldn't do by working as individuals. So one wonders how much more capacity that they have. And one of the interesting things as you get into the various traits of the DNA being passed down from the giants, that it's a specific gens, as they like to talk about in these royales, whether or not it's the Julia gens or the Elby gens or the Fairy gens or the Gene of Isis and all the different other ones of gens, is like from Zeus is another one, that it's the genes that produce the Rh negative blood that shows up in very high doses within the royales, so like the Windsors are O negative, for example. And that within the surveys done for people who are Rh negative, and I pulled several of them to create a list on a document on the Rh document I can send people, is people with Rh negative bloodlines say they have unique traits. And one of them is a higher average intelligence of 135 plus. So now if that's been diluted over the millennia, did they have some astronomical number at one point in time? We don't know. But intelligence doesn't necessarily equate with wisdom either. So you can become very narcissistic with that intelligence and diabolical, so to speak, as an evil genius, right, as the word is understood as. So, and more telepathic abilities in that Rh negative. So, yeah, I think there's a possibility that they had, high levels of intelligence. But again, we have no idea how much they were able to maximize out of that brain capacity.
Well, you know, we generally think of giants as being stupid, you know, and not intelligent at all. And yet the giants that appear to have been created, the Nephilim, appear to be intelligent and conspiratorial and, you know, they have warlike abilities and inclinations. Yep. But they're not stupid. Usually like in, Jack and the Beanstalk, you know, the giant was stupid and lumbering and clumsy. And it our concept of the kind of giants you're talking about really needs to change, because these were intelligent individuals.
And if we understand that they dominated the upper two classes of the four class system, and even into Europe with the feudal system, it's the same four class system, that in that upper class system was all of the educated elite. Who created all the great writing classics, created the great music, created, you know, the arts and the sciences that you know, have come down. And only in the last couple hundred years has the mundane been permitted to really start participating in that, which they'll probably reel back in not too long of a period of time. So I think we have to be very much aware that they are very intelligent. They always have been, and we better not underestimate them, and that they think that they're still superior and that they can do everything in plain sight and that we're too mundane to understand. And so they can pretty much do what they will and sort of organize the flow of the world. The thing that they can't seem to quite do is work well enough together to hit that end goal. Of that one world empire and that one imposed religion that they've been working on forever. But eventually, once the restrainer has been removed, they're going to be able to do it.
Yeah, I think that we're seeing a lot of, there's so much ego involved in everything that's going on today, that the element of a one world order, it's just not the time for it. It won't work because, you know, somebody's got to be in control and everybody thinks it's them. So while we may be in end times to a degree, I think we're not at the place where things are going to be pulled together In order for one world, you have to get along, and that's not happening yet.
Yeah, but I do think the idea of extinction might get people to sort of work together. So if the catastrophes get to be large enough, it might be sort of this force thing, and then we'll be running into sort of open arms of the people who say they have the solutions. I think how we get there is the transition of these catastrophes with the 10-king world government, so that there won't be just one that is going to be controlling the whole world. The world gets separated into 10 groups of countries or 10 empires. And if that sounds familiar, that's exactly how the UN has divided the world. And that if that sounds familiar, that's exactly how and why the Club of Rome was created and divided the world into 10 empires. If that sounds familiar, that's how the world was designed to be ruled over with the 10-king empire of Atlantis before the flood, before Atlantis was destroyed with the flood. And in the book of Daniel, we get the metallic empires, which has the 10 toes of 10 kings in the end time empire that rises, and then the 10 horns of the beast empires in Daniel 7. And then you have these same 10 kings showing up in Revelation 12, 13, and 17 of this end time empire. And so they're going to divvy up the world under these, what I think are 10 bloodlines, to rule the world with their universal religion, which will be the rising Babylon. But to get there is going to require the birth sorrows to get a lot stronger. That includes more than just wars, but earthquakes and pestilence and famine. And it's going to have to come about through that sort of process, and that you can't go right to one king, but it's those 10 kings that will hand their power over to Antichrist because they grow jealous of the universal religion, and that's how you get to one.
We're a long way from that, it feels.
And it's why I try and encourage people not to get ahead of end time chronology. There's too much to happen yet. So to think that we're going to be at Armageddon in 2 or 3 years or maybe even 10 years, there's still too much to happen to be put into place. I think it's moving as we go through the fig tree generation. And I have a whole section later on in the book on the fig tree generation, but you have to have a start. When does that fig tree generation start, and how long is a generation? And if it's 120 years, then if it doesn't matter whether your people are placing that at 1947 at the declaration of Israel or taking of the Jerusalem city in 1967, if it's 120 years, there's still lots of time. If it's 70 years, we're getting into that window. But again, I think it's going to, if it's like the days of Noah, as one of the overarching signs, we might want to be focusing more in on the 120 years. It doesn't have to go the full 120 years. And it's certainly not 950 years, but hey, that's how long Noah lived. But I think it would be the 120 years in Genesis 6:3. So depending on what is the kickoff of the fig tree generation, we're still in the sorrows, and it could be a while. And I know people love to get ahead of end time chronology. I would encourage people not to.
Well, I mean, it will come when it comes in its own time. I think that what we're looking at here, though, especially with the giants, I'm fascinated with them. I mean, there have been giant bones discovered all over the world. That they existed is absolute. They did. Even if, you know, history and archaeology is trying to hide them, they're there. The bones are there. The Smithsonian couldn't destroy them all. But, you know, it's kind of like people need to understand where we came from, and that's what your books do such a magnificent job of, because understanding where you came from gives you a place of where you are and with hope where you're going to go. And I think that, you know, we're the element of giants. I mean, there are people around with giantism, but that's I don't know if that's a genetic kickback or if it's something else. But, you know, I think that our DNA is so screwed up that we may be finding birthing of people who are indeed giants. There are people out there, especially playing basketball, that are very tall. And so could it be that the DNA is starting to reappear?
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I mean, I'm not convinced of that we're starting. I think we're just seeing with nutrition and better living conditions that there isn't a stunting of the growth, and we might be getting to sort of our maximum size of our DNA, although it may be expandable a little bit more. I think, though, that we're going to see in an introduction of giants somehow, some way, if it's going to be like the days of Noah. I think for sure through the participation of the descendants of these bloodlines. I mean, they're the ones that are working today to bring about this one world government and this universal religion. But I also think that if it's going to be like the days of Noah, and there was giants both before and after the flood, and as I covered off in chapter one, why we need to have a fuller understanding of the days of Noah, and that's why I let off the book with that, is that we're either going to see giants that somehow have survived and are going to reappear in the earth, off the earth, in another dimension, in stasis, whatever, or there's going to be a recreation of the giants. And for sure, we're going to see a technology get to a point where you can create sleeves or cloned bodies to permit the disembodied spirits to enter into that aren't into the pit prison. And certainly by the time the ones that are in the pit prison, as you get closer to the midpoint of the last 7 years, are going to have Oikotarians ready for them at that point in time. And we have, you know, a connection to the royals and the royal bloodline as we get New Testament prophecy. I do cover it in the end of the book, but we can talk a little bit about how we know that these kings of the earth are talking about the same sort of bloodline and kinds of people that were running the beast empires. So I think somehow, some way, but because of that days of Noah understanding and with Ecclesiastics that, you know, what was will be again, there's nothing new under the sun. We're going to see that cycle come back around.
You know, science has worked with DNA and recreating the dinosaurs and recreating lots of things. There are skulls that have the teeth, which is where you can get good DNA samples from. They could recreate giants. I'm surprised they haven't tried.
Oh, I'm sure they're trying. And just as Jurassic Park, you know, clearly makes it, that is something in plain sight that I think we ought not to totally sort of dismiss. And in book one, I do talk about you could create giants through DNA manipulation or recreating from old DNA. And I think that's another way that we can get there. It doesn't have to be another like third incursion type of scenario. But, and what's interesting as well is, you know, in, I think it was in 2017, you had Hillary Clinton and her people that were requesting documents pertaining to the resurrection chamber of Gilgamesh, the location of his body, and the location of buried Nephilim. And in that, as you get in deeper into that request, it says, and I can actually I'll give the, I have it in front of me here, I'll give the FOIA number. So it is F-2019-02110. And it says on that official request, it says, requesting documents pertaining to the resurrection chamber of Gilgamesh, the location of his body, and the location of the buried Nephilim. Why would they want to have that? You would think that would be reserved for archaeology and museums and things like that. Two reasons. One is the DNA.
Yeah.
They could recreate giants through that DNA or insert whatever they do with the regeneration of that DNA to insert in humans to create maybe more hybrids. And the sarcophagus, the resurrection chamber. So there's a thought that, I mean, and we talked about in shows past in about the book on book two here, is that Rapha can mean to heal, and that that's the source word for the Rapha spirit and the Rapha giant words in Hebrew, and that they could heal themselves and heal others in the Ugaritic texts. And so you don't really get a sarcophagus technology chamber there, but you have that DNA that has that self-healing power, which is why you had to take their heads to make sure that they stayed dead, because they could grow back arms and things like that. But the other school of thought is that there was a technology through the sarcophagus that they could regenerate through that. And we saw that sort of ideology in several science fiction shows and movies, but the most self-evident one would have been in the Stargate series with the Gauld in their sarcophagus, where they could literally bring people back from the dead and heal themselves. And then you have this FOIA request for this information. And, you just have to, I'll just read it again. The resurrection chamber of Gilgamesh, not just a sarcophagus. They're calling it a resurrection chamber. So part of the ritual that they would be resurrected in their belief system, but you wouldn't want the chamber for that unless there was a technology associated with it.
I'm fascinated by the fact that, I mean, was the request granted? Did they get that information?
Somebody like Hillary Clinton and her people would be able to get it. Absolutely. They have clearance, right? So.
Yeah. Well, that's very scary.
Yeah, I have if some people want to get a hold of me through my website, I can send them that page. It has the links on there. You can go and see for yourself.
Well, it just seems that there are people out there that are trying to draw upon the energy and the enthusiasm of giants and overtaking and overpowering. And like you said, you know, they're in more of a human form now today than they ever have been. But that being said, there is that internal questing for control that is still
and
there.
You know, there is. And combined with that obsession to recreate the demigods, I mean, we start to look at, and I cover Vril off in book one, and Vril, I mean, it's Rosicrucian, and it's also a belief that was passed on for the Nazis in World War II, is something in the blood that if you could backwards engineer it, you could recreate the demigods both before and after the flood. And that's part of that whole ideology that they're wanting to recreate the giants. And
now I've got a question. Are they trying to recreate the giants, or are they trying to create an avatar for the spirit of the giants to take over?
I think both, because you have disembodied spirits that need to have a Oikitarian, host. A dwelling place for that spirit, right? Yeah, have to have a host, whether it's an empty host or one that acquiesces to permit somebody in. I think probably they'll lean towards hostless bodies, so a clone body of some sort that doesn't have a spirit in it already. So I think it's both. And, you know, what the Nazis did is an analogy for the end time. It's the longest chapter I write in book one, because I just wanted to get so much of how we can look at that as Hitler as being an Antichrist wannabe, and his goals were the same thing as bringing about this globalist empire. I mean, it was going to be a 1,000-year rule of the Third Reich. And they had their own universal religion that they had created in 1933, and they were absolutely obsessed with occult knowledge and with the giants. And they were even trying to create their blonde hair, blue-eyed Aryan giants going forward just through, you know, breeding and narrowing that process down. I don't know whether that would have worked or not, but they certainly were smitten with that.
Yeah, I've met somebody that was a baby from that, her mother was in a breeding farm and, you know, blonde-haired, blue eyes, and she was mated with somebody who was and she was blonde-haired, blue eyes, and she grew up in that environment as being one of a special race, and hard for her to reinsert herself into society when she had the 10-12 years of it being bred into her that she was special.
Yeah, the new man, the new superior being. And one thing is, as I dug deeper into the understanding, there's a rival between the red-haired and the blonde hair, that the red hair is considered to be more superior than the blonde hair, which is not sure how or why they got there, but that seems to be part of the internal rivalry as well.
Well, you had your red-haired giants in Nevada that were destroyed by the Indians, but I know that there's just... I am still blown away by the numbers, the legions of giants there were. It makes the story so much bigger, you know, rather than, you know, oh, there were three or four and, you know, here are their names. I mean, it feels as though there were legions of them. There were cities of them. So,
oh, yeah.
So to
great cities. And it's these hybrids that lived amongst them as well. It was a two-tiered system of giants. But initially there would have been, you know, a massive number of giants even shortly, you know, after the flood. And, you know, people, if they want to know more about giant and giant tribes, you know, tune in next week. And when we get into section four, we're going to cover off all the various giants that were listed in the Bible. And it's a big number. But understand that if you're trying to understand the geopolitical nature of the time of Abraham and then of the Israel conquest, you need to understand who all of the hybrids were, whether it's the Girgashites or the Arvidites, and, you know, how they made up different pockets of the empires. You know, that you have the great Hittite empire, you know, that comes from Heth, and how that intermingled with other giants. And you have, you know, formation of the Phoenician empire. It was like a beast empire, but of a financial nature that seemed to be part of most beast empires. And that was made up of, you know, the Sidonians, and intermarrying with giants as well. And many of the tribes, there's several tribes that are associated from the patriarchless Canaanites that made up that Phoenician empire. So if you want to understand sort of the geopolitical nature and how these tribes participated, that's what Section 3 sort of provides for you, in that taking it back to a specific patriarch for each of those hybrid giants is sort of just setting the table for how much the giants change things when you start to see that there's way more giants than just that were producing these hybrids. They were one of a tribe of giants that one of them was selected to start a hybrid nation. And so
I have a question.
To give you a bit.
So,
yeah, go ahead.
So, I mean, they were 17 feet high, some of them. And you're talking about mating with human women. Now, how did that happen? I mean, somebody that large would kill a human female if he tried to mate with her. So how did it happen?
Yeah, because you have to have the mother survive, at least to bear the baby. So how does that happen?
Yeah.
So again, if you go to reliefs that they show in throughout the Middle East, is you would have, because it's different than fallen angels who have sort of a changeling capability, so they could accommodate their size, right? They would still pass on DNA, but they could accommodate the size. Now, with the giants, though, you see rituals on the reliefs where it's a fertility ritual, but they're pouring a vial of semen into a woman. And I think that's how they did it initially, until you created enough hybrids that were large enough to accommodate the larger giants.
Gotcha. Okay. That makes sense. All I could think of was...
Yeah.
You know, it just doesn't compute. But, artificial insemination is all over the place. So, yeah, that would make sense. But then again, the baby would be so huge, wouldn't it kill the mother?
Probably it did in many cases, just as it did with the original Nephilim before the flood.
Well, that sucks.
But there was plenty of humans to continue to try with if they were lost, childbirth. So, yeah.
Cannon fodder. Well, the other thing that I am so fascinated with is the Tuatha De Danann, how they came in here. I did not realize they were that far back.
Well, they're actually before the flood as well. I think they accept the eponymous name after the flood. I cover off in book one how they show up. They're a massive race of giants before the flood. So they either survive, or the recreated ones will take their name. I tend to fall into that second incursion, although I still keep a crack open for some giants surviving. But biblically, it fits better with the second incursion. They're the same name after the flood as before the flood. And so it can only be they either survived or, like some of the other giants, and one particular giant tribe who takes their name from Cain, that we'll talk about next week, it's not uncommon to accept the names both as a tribe or a nation from before the flood, just as the Greeks took their name from the antediluvian Greeks. Well, how is that possible? Well, they just sort of said, we're going to accept that as they moved into the same area where those Greeks would have lived. And just as you have giants that have the same names both before and after the flood. So Gilgamesh is a classic example of sixth generation after the flood. And he's created by a mother goddess, Nin, with Lugalvanda, king of Uruk. And that's sixth generation after the flood. But also in the Enoch Book of Giants, you have a Gilgamesh before the flood. It is quite common, whether it's Gog or Magog and other giants, that was a common practice, that somehow they had knowledge of names of the giants before the flood.
Goodness. Well, we are closing in on our the end of our show. Can you let people know how they can get your material and your website and how to get a hold of you and stuff like that there?
Yeah, so if people wanted to get an RH negative document or some other information on stuff that I might have mentioned today, if I have a document, I can send it to you or I'll answer your question. With the fulfilling of my orders, I'm out 2 months now on response time, but I'll have that caught up to at least to a month or less. So you have to be patient. I will get back to you. I go in order as they come in. So you can get a hold of me through my website at thegenesis6conspiracy.com. That's Genesis 6, the number 6, conspiracy.com. On that website, there is a contact the author. You go and you click on that. That's my email, or you can just email me directly at Genesis 6, again, the number 6, Genesis6conspiracy@gmail.com. That's my website email address, and it will come directly through to me. And you can get a generous excerpt of all 98 chapters of Book 1 off of the website. You can also get a generous excerpt of all 84 chapters of Book 2 that's on the website. And just the table of contents for each should get your attention. And if you think you've got all the information from either book with a generous excerpt, you've not read one of my books before. You know that you will know if you've read one of them that it just doesn't stop coming at you with more and more information until the last chapter is done. And if you wanted to buy a copy and support me and get a signed copy of either book, just go to book one or book two and on the buy now. And if you're in Canada, there's a Canada page. If you're in US, there's a US page. And if you live anywhere else in the world, there's an international page. Select your page, buy your book, and I will send you a signed copy. I tend to ship books within 2 or 3 days of receiving the orders. So you can get a signed copy that way. And if you wanted to get multiple copies, you can order in quantities for either. Now, if you wanted to get a legacy sort of tradition of two new ones, or you want to buy both at the same time, go to one of the books that are the same price, order two, and send me a note and how you want it signed and that you want one of each, and I will send that off to you. Or if you wanted to buy 10 and however you wanted it split, just send me the note. I'll split them and sign them accordingly. You can also link over to BarnesandNoble.com and Amazon.com and Amazon.ca to get a copy of either book, and it takes you right to the page on to buy the book on Amazon. And there's also a Kindle edition that is available for both, and they have that link on it where it'll take you right over to that. And we just got the deal done, and it's already in process that book one will be coming out on audio. It's going to be about 60 hours to produce, so the audio book for book one will be in about 2 months, and then depending on whether that gets done on schedule, there will be book two on audio as well, and it'll be available through Amazon. I'll have those links up when we get there. And so I'm pretty excited about that. It's a very complicated project. Just from the different names of people and words that are used in both of the books, it's takes a lot of back and forth between the reader to get the right pronunciation, and there's multiple pronunciations, believe me. So it's a complex process, but I'm just so excited there's finally going to be audiobooks for both, providing it doesn't fall apart because it's just too complicated to do. That has happened before, but I'm pretty sure these guys are committed and they're going to get it done, and they have the ability to get it done.
Whew. Well, I thank you so much. This is, I've never done seven, you know, Mondays straight with material, but that was the only way we could do your book, to be honest.
Yeah. So, and you know, it was the same with sort of book one, is that, you know, there's 8 sections in there, and, you know, to do shows on my book, it's like, well, we can give you an overview, but it is so massive in terms of material and information that you could never sort of cover it off in
in one show. So this has been very nice opportunity to be able to go through in sections and sort of give people a good idea what each section is all about.
Well, maybe after I catch my breath, we'll go back and do book one again.
Hey, that'd be a good plan.
Yeah, but, you know, over 8 weeks.
Sure.
It should be interesting. Well, I want to thank you so much. We're down to a couple seconds, and I will look forward to talking to you tomorrow night. Not tomorrow night, next
awesome.
Monday. Next Monday.
Perfect.
Thank you. Bye-bye now. Okay, everybody. We'll see you next Monday and learn so much more. This is such an exciting time for me, and I hope it's for you as well. We will see you next Monday. Good night now.